This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It was an image straight out of Hollywood, a 180-foot, three-masted wooden ship tossed about helplessly in the middle of a raging storm. Two dead, the remaining 14 crew members at risk, and a heroic rescue effort by the Coast Guard.
We're right over the raft, back 10.
On that raft, in the middle of the roiling sea, with Sandy bearing down members of the crew of the HMS Bounty, who were swept overboard by a giant wave on Sunday. Then, a welcome sight, the outstretched hand of rescue swimmer Dan Todd of the U.S. Coast Guard.
So I jumped in and I said, hey, I'm Dan. I heard you guys need a ride.
Just two rescuers towing the 14 crew members one by one to Coast Guard helicopters, hovering 30 feet above the water, fighting 50-mile-per-hour winds.
It's like a washing machine. I mean, you have 20 to 30-foot waves hitting you from different sides.
As Hurricane Sandy pounded the East Coast, the HMS Bounty struggled and eventually sank miles off the coast of North Carolina. It was a replica of the famous British vessel. It was the one moviegoers saw in the 1962 feature film Mutiny on the Bounty. The story captured the imagination of local journalist Matthew Scher. He wrote a book about the epic event. It's called The Sinking of the Bounty, and Matthew joins us now in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the original HMS Bounty, the original historic ship.
The original Bounty set sail from England in 1787, and the purpose was to collect breadfruit, which is a fruit that provides a lot of sustenance, more sustenance than a normal fruit. And the hope was that breadfruit would be able to be used to feed slaves in the colonies, in the British colonies. So the Bounty set sail with a lieutenant, a relatively young lieutenant. I believe he was 32 when the Bounty left England. The plan was to collect the fruit in Tahiti. This lieutenant, Captain Bligh, who later became quite famous, ran into some trouble right off the bat. And it took the crew about 10 full months to get to Tahiti. They had originally hoped to go around Africa, but it wasn't possible. They had to turn the other direction instead. And by the time they got there, the crew was dissatisfied, to say the least, and arguments were breaking out on a regular basis. Now, they stay in Tahiti for about 5 months, during which time the crew members marry Tahitian women and start families. So when Bligh says, okay, time to get back on the boat, we're headed back to England, they're not particularly happy. And one, the master's mate, Fletcher Christian, also a young guy, was particularly unhappy. And the crew did allow Bligh to leave Tahiti. They did leave and started the trip back. But after a couple of days, they staged a mutiny. And essentially what happened was Fletcher Christian took control of the Bounty and put Bligh onto a smaller boat. Now, the idea, obviously what Christian was thinking was that Bligh was going to die. They left him with some supplies. But I think what sometimes gets lost in history is that Bligh, incredibly enough, made it 3,800 nautical miles with a very small crew all the way to a Dutch colony in Timor. And he eventually went on to a career, a middling career in the Navy. But Fletcher Christian and a lot of the mutineers made it to Pitcairn Island, where they also sort of started a mini colony, so to speak. They did burn the Bounty, and they sunk it off the coast of Pitcairn. And for a long time, no one knew exactly what had happened to the mutineers, but I think it was about 20 years later, an American sealer vessel, came to Pitcairn Island. And by then, I think there was only one survivor left. Christian was gone. And the people on Pitcairn told the sealer that Christian had died. But later there were rumors, in fact, that he was alive and well in England. And essentially what happened is right away it was adapted for the stage. But later there were novels. And, of course, there were a lot of movies starring a range of leading men, Errol Flynn. And
you know, what was it about? There had to be lots and lots of mutinies in the days, particularly during colonialization. What was it about this particular story, do you think, that gave it its long life?
I think that the idea of Fletcher Christian from the beginning really appealed to readers and to theater goers. I mean, he was in the movies, he's always cast, and in books, he's always cast as sort of a handsome rebel, which by all evidence he was. And that captured people's attention. But also I think the stay in Tahiti was fascinating because this was a crew of men who, well in Tahiti, lived a Tahitian lifestyle. You know, they tattooed themselves, which shocked everybody back in England. Full tattoos from neck down to feet, and they had children on Tahiti. And, you know, that in the Marlon Brando movie, that obviously plays a big part. But I think that you're right, there were mutinies, but this one was, it was so dramatic. And there was also this idea that Bligh had made it all the way back by himself with a small crew. That's pretty amazing.
So a number of film versions of this. The 1962 version is the one we're interested in because that one, starring Marlon Brando, is the one that for which the ship was created, the one that was lost in Sandy. Well, tell us about the replica.
The replica in many ways is faithful to the original, but it is larger. Now, they made it larger in order to accommodate camera crews. There was no way, if they'd built it, if it had been an exact model, they wouldn't have been able to fit all the cameras below decks that they would have needed. So it's a little bit larger. In other ways, it's mostly faithful. Now, it was created in 1960 in Nova Scotia. It was built in Nova Scotia. And they sailed it south for the filming. Now, the movie came out in 1962, and in the final scene, the original script called for the replica to be burned, as it was in the historical record. But Brando had formed an attachment to the ship, and he decided that he wanted to save it. So when the filming was concluded, they burned a much smaller model instead. That's what you see at the end of the Marlon Brando version of Mutiny on the Bounty. And the original boat went into the MGM, or the replica boat went into the MGM Library of Film Props.
It's in the prop room, you know. I'm looking for a hat and a mustache. What's that boat doing over there? So it stayed in the prop room for a while, and then it made its way out. What happened to it? How did it become not a prop anymore?
Ted Turner acquired the entire library of MGM film props during an acquisition of MGM, and he had no use for this boat, which was he wasn't going to sail.
But he was a yachtsman, wasn't he?
It's true.
Is he?
apparently, this was too much. This was above his pay grade.
I mean,
something like this requires a full crew. It also requires an organization that's able to maintain it on a regular basis. Mm. A big boat. So essentially, Turner donated it to an organization in Fall River in Massachusetts. And for a while, it operated as a nonprofit in Fall River, and people could come aboard and tour it. But later on, a man named Robert Hansen bought it, and he started a company. It was not a nonprofit. It was a for-profit enterprise where he would own the replica Bounty, and the crew would sail it up and down the East Coast, sometimes into the Great Lakes, once or twice, I believe, across the Atlantic, at least once. And the tour schedule for the Bounty was typically they'd hole up in a port for about 3 days. People would be allowed on board. It was mostly families. You know, it's kind of a floating museum. So you'd come on board, get to pose next to the masts, get to take some pictures. And for that, tourists were usually charged about $10.
So apparently it was a seaworthy vessel, and it was maintained as such. I mean, they were actually going up and down the coast, right?
They were going up and down the coast, but from the mid-90s on, it was apparent that the boat was not in as good condition as she could have been. There were several incidents, including an infamous incident in 1998 where a bad leak was sprung in the hull, and the Coast Guard and the Navy were called on scene, and they were forced to drop pumps to the Bounty, to the crew, in order to get the water out of the engine room. And the boat eventually limped back to shore.
So last year was not the first time the Coast Guard had to come to the rescue of the replica of the Bounty.
Not by any means. When I started interviewing former crew members, this is something that surprised me right away. You know, I had one guy who described it as a Lego toy. They were always digging in the toy box for more Lego parts to slap onto the boat. Wow. And it was a badge of honor to have sailed on the Bounty because she was not in perfect condition. So, no, by no means was this the first incident.
So how did this thing find it? Because Sandy is really the one of the perfect storms, right? I mean, it's a rough storm. And this boat is out in the bad weather. Tell us about that story. How did it come to be on the high seas during the storm?
So this is – we're talking the end of the season for the Bounty. This is October. And the plan had – the Bounty had been in Booth Bay Harbor undergoing repairs that fall. Now, from Booth Bay Harbor, she sailed to New London, Connecticut. This is at the end of October. And the Bounty crew gave a tour for a submarine crew, a Navy submarine crew that was based in New London. Now, the plan at this point, as most people will remember, the storm was everywhere. Everyone knew that the storm was coming. It was not a surprise. This did not sneak up on anybody. But the captain, Captain Robin Walbridge, believed that he could make it south to Florida around the storm. Now, the plan was to go from New London straight to Florida and then from Florida to Texas, where she'd be put up for the winter months. Now, initially, he believed that he could get around it to the east. The original course that he plotted was south by southeast around the storm, and they gave themselves about 14 days to get to Florida.
He was wrong. Coast Guard had to come to the rescue. Describe that. It was quite a rescue.
It was an amazing rescue, and I spoke extensively to some of the Coast Guard crew, helicopter pilots, rescue swimmers. To a person, no one had experienced a storm like that. When the C-130, which is a big Coast Guard plane, a gigantic plane, it's called the Hercules, left Elizabeth City in North Carolina, the air was so rough that three crew members in that plane were throwing up uncontrollably on their way to the site. That's how rough the air was. Now, that C-130 circled over the Bounty for about 4 hours. And finally, two helicopters were summoned from Elizabeth City. Each of those helicopters had one rescue swimmer on board. Now, there were 16 crew members on the Bounty. There were 14 survivors. Now, of those 14 survivors, they managed to get into life rafts, two different life rafts. The rescue swimmers dropped into the water and over a series of hours pulled all those survivors out of the life rafts. Now, we're talking waves that are two-story building waves. Now, one of the rescue swimmers who we heard on that clip, Daniel Todd, who's 28 years old, this is the first time he'd experienced anything like that. He pulled nine survivors himself out of the water. And by the end, it was so much strain that he was throwing up because he couldn't handle it. But they did get everybody out. It's amazing. They got everybody into those two helicopters except for the captain who was lost at sea and one of the mates who died during the sinking.
And there's a court case now surrounding that the rescue and, in fact, that outing, right? Tell us about that.
The Coast Guard convened a hearing in February into the sinking. Now, they can't arrive at a decision themselves, the Coast Guard, a criminal decision, and they can't hold anybody liable for money in the sinking. But what they can do is take testimony from all the remaining survivors, the owner of the boat, and Coast Guard rescuers and so on. And that testimony can later be used in civil court. Now, one of the people who was lost, this woman Claudine Christian, a 42-year-old, her parents were on hand for the hearings, and they had retained a lawyer. Now, their lawyer is not saying one way or another for certain whether he is going to sue, but you know, safe money is that there is a lawsuit in the works.
Right. When you say they can't come to a conclusion, they legally it's beyond their scope to do that, but they can certainly develop enough evidence, as you say, to be used in court.
And they did. I mean, they were able to produce some pretty stunning testimony from boatyard workers, for instance.
Tell us about this. You published it. You wrote a book about this, and you published it on a kind of unique platform, a unique model. Tell us about that.
The platform is called The Atavist. It's a Brooklyn-based publisher. It was started a couple of years ago by three friends who traditionally worked in or who had come from print backgrounds and were looking for new ways to tell stories, multimedia stories. So the books that The Atavist publishes are available in text-only versions. They're available on you can search on Amazon for The Sinking of the Bounty and you'll find it. Same with Kobo and Nook. But they also produce a multimedia version which includes video, audio, interactive maps. So from the beginning, when I sat down to write this story, I knew the Coast Guard had cooperated from the beginning, and we knew that they would provide us with videos. And so if you download the multimedia version, you can actually see videos from inside the helicopter while the rescue is going on.
This is obviously a compelling story, but one that a lot of us saw and then let go. What was it about this? Is this had the bounty always been interesting to you? What got you attached to this story?
I think, like a lot of people, my first sight of, or my first experience with the sinking itself, was seeing a newspaper article that featured a picture which became iconic. It was taken by a Coast Guard mechanic who was in one of the helicopters on his iPhone. And it's a picture of the Bounty slipping under the ocean. And it seemed so out of place, this giant wooden boat in the middle of the worst storm, and also the largest in terms of scale, not in severity, but in terms of scale, the largest in the Atlantic Basin. And I just wanted to know, as I suspect a lot of people did, how that boat had found herself there in the middle of that storm.
It's a great story, Matthew. Thank you so much for sharing it and putting that book together.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Scheer is a freelance journalist in Durham. To read more about him or his book, The Sinking of the Bounty, go to matthewscheer.com. Scheer is spelled S-H-A-E-R. And that's our program for today. You know our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is directed by Alex Granados, produced by Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wynn, and Nicole Campbell. Christina Blyde is our intern, Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.